got police hack if you wanted the nameplates like that, which is how they were done this morning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Great.
Hello.
Hello.
Is anyone covering the issue of right to advocacy and advice?
I don't know. Because I haven't got a sneak preview.
That's not in the existing human rights, so except insofar as if you've got an imbalance of treatment before a judicial hearing.
Well, we are going to be inviting questions. So
can I ask?
Of course you can, yes.
But because that affects the whole social rights.
Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay. Gordon. Hi.
Sarah, nice to meet you.
Hi, Francis.
Hi, to meet you.
Hi.
I take it you have a 4-minute speech, not longer.
No, well, it's Honoré de Balzac, isn't it? I'm sorry I've written you a long speech. I didn't have time to write it.
We have to make sure that Andy shuts himself out.
Well, Francis can help me by nudging him hard in the ribs.
I give you permission to give him a...
Why, have we had lots of people who've overrun this morning then?
No, it's just Andy.
No.
It's quite a challenging
course. Yes.
Hi, Lucy. Hi, Sarah. Hi, Francis. How are you?
You okay for water? If you want something that's not sparkling.
Hello, Andy.
Hi, good to see you.
Yes, very active Twitter space. Yes, trying not to break your fingers.
Tight table.
Which wall is this one?
I'm going to keep it very, very short. So you can have lots of questions.
Okay, you ready?
Will there be anything else? No, right. Yeah.
Whose is that? Is that turn? Does that belong to? Is that yours? Yeah, I thought it might be. Thank you.
Right, hello, good afternoon everyone. Is this working? Yes it is. Okay, I speak into it like that. This is the session on Justice Under Siege and how can Labour save fundamental rights. My name is Sarah Ibrahim. I'm Vice Chair of the Fabian Society and also a barrister. I have four excellent panellists with me this afternoon who, even better, have all promised they have 4-minute speeches and they have no intention of going over 4 minutes, so they can spend lots of time answering what I hope are going to be some very pert questions from the audience. So what I'm going to do after I introduce all of our panellists is to ask for contributions, and by contributions I mean questions rather than statements from the floor, and I will take them in batches of three. So once we have done as many questions as we can do in the allocated time, I will then ask all of the four panellists to sum up their thoughts. The first speaker today is going to be Andy Slaughter, MP, who is a Shadow Minister for Justice and has been, I know, a great friend to the Society of Labour Lawyers and has done an awful lot of work on a whole variety of justice issues, including, among other things, access to justice, which is very much a hot topic at the moment. We're then going to hear from Francis Crook, who's Chief Executive of the Howard League for Penal Reform, followed third by Lucy Rigby, the Lincoln parliamentary candidate, or she was in 2015, who will be able to tell us, no doubt, about some of the comments on the doorstep about these kinds of issues, if it did come up. And then finally, we're going to have Gordon Nardell, QC, barrister, current chair of the Bar Council of the EU Law Committee, but very excitingly was involved in drafting the Human Rights Act, which was mentioned today by Jeremy Corbyn as one of the key bits of legislation, along with the Equality Act, which he was particularly proud of. And I think, Gordon, perhaps you're the only person who's speaking today who has worked on the legal side, both for Blair and Corbyn, perhaps proving that we really can be a unified party after all. So, Andy, if I just set my iPhone timer for 4 minutes, I will let you take it away.
Okay. Yeah, can you hear me? Yeah, sure, with or without the microphone. Yeah, for those who don't know me, I'm the MP at Hammersmith. I've been the Shadow Justice Minister since appointed by Ed Miliband in September 2010. So I think that makes me the longest serving person in any one job. I don't know what I've done to deserve that, although I'm now, of course, Charlie. So I've worked for Steve Carr for 5 years. I'm now working with Charlie Faulkner, but obviously because he's in the House of Lords, I lead on Justice Council in the House of Commons, and but particularly now on human rights, which I've put up my last minute. It's quite a difficult question to answer this, because there's a bit of a phony war going on at the moment. Most of the damage was set in train under Clark and Grayling in the last Parliament. And the wheels of justice turn quite slowly sometimes, and the sort of acts that they pass, the LASPO Act and transforming legal aid and things like that, are only just now being the consequences are being felt. Also true that Gove's had a bit of a honeymoon period in the job, because he's undone some of the worst things that Grayling did, from prisoner book bans through to the court's charge and things of that nature. And the third thing is he's making noises, Francis will say more about this, about being a prison reformer. Now, they are only noises, and actually most of the things that are happening in our prisons are pretty terrible at the moment. There is a real crisis, and people may have seen the Panorama programme on G4S and the mistreatment of children in prison this week. So they are noises, and I suspect it has more to do with money. He knows he can't squeeze much more out of legal aid or the courts, and therefore he wants fewer people in prison because he needs to save a substantial amount of money. So where that actually leaves us is still is that every week there are horror stories. And in the last week, we had the CPS effectively saying that they couldn't afford to prosecute cases, at the same time as the Lord Chief Justice was saying in his annual report that most people could no longer afford civil litigation. So things like the increases in court fees, things like the Jackson reforms, which make no win, no fee difficult, and of course the cuts in legal aid, means this really is a fundamental change in the way that justice is working. Now, I wasn't here for Jeremy's warning. I'd be surprised if Jeremy didn't mention, along with human rights, legal aid. And I went to the, if anyone here went to the Conway Hall last week for the Justice Alliance rally, where Jeremy was sort of greeted as a rock star, because he has pedigree on this. He has stood up for legal aid over many, many years. We now have a legal aid review going on that Lord Bark and Carl Turner, the new Shadow Attorney General, are leading to completely look again at Labour's line on legal aid. Because I know my 4 minutes are running out, I won't say any more about that, and I'm sure that will come up in questions. So the final point I would want to cover is human rights. Very interesting article from The Sun, for those of you who buy The Sun, today, saying that the reason that the Human Rights Act repeal has been delayed is they want to use it as a bit of a dog whistle politics for the EU referendum, i.e. it's going to be bad news, it's going to be all the shroud waving about terrorism and foreign prisoners and and votes for prisoners and things of that kind, and it's going to be a no doubt legally incompetent and tabloid pleasing session, this new British Bill of Rights, in order to try and cover up the lack of concessions that Cameron is getting from Europe. I can't think of a worse basis to go into human rights reform, even if such were needed, which we don't think it is. So that's the agenda for us. A lot of that clearly will be in Parliament, the Human Rights Act repeal particularly. A lot of it is going to take place outside through things like the Justice Alliance, because what we're dealing with now is the consequences. We're not dealing so much with legislation, we're dealing with the consequences of legislation that's already taken place and which, as I say, fundamentally changes the balance between the state and the citizen in terms of people being able to enforce their legal and constitutional rights in a way that we haven't seen since the Second World War. That was surprise rather than approbation.
We have a lively relationship.
Thank you very much, Andy, and very close to the 4-minute time limit. There are a couple of seats for those of you who are standing, if some of you want to come and take a seat. There's one here. I'm not sure if there are any at the back there.
Anyway, nobody else can
do it, so. Francis.
Hello, everybody. Three things. First of all, very quickly, the Howard League is a charity, so I'm speaking here on behalf of an independent and impartial charity. And, of course, we are also independent of government. We don't take government money, so please do join us, because we rely on people supporting us. Secondly, I'm going to talk about Labour's mistakes, which I hope Labour won't repeat next time it's in government, and then give some ideas about some successes and things it could build on for a change policy. But you've got to learn from the mistakes you made in government last time. And if you hands up who saw the Medway programme on G4S. Right, it was Labour that brought in the STCs. It was Labour that signed the contracts, not for Medway, but for the others, with G4S. It was Labour that oversaw an explosion in locking up children in places like Medway. If you haven't seen it, watch it. It's horrific. It's on an iPlayer. It was also Labour that oversaw an explosion in the use of indeterminate sentences. So we now have more life sentence prisoners in England and Wales than every other country in the Council of Europe combined. So we have more life sentence prisoners in England and Wales than Russia, Germany, France, Spain, Italy, all of them combined. It's an explosion in the use of indeterminate sentences. And when you're received into prison, when you on the IPP, it says 99 years on the computer. It made a mistake in building more prisons, which is being replicated now by Gove. You cannot build your way out of a prison crisis. I mean, it's just like motorways. The more you build, the more they get filled up. So the idea that you can send lots of people to prison and build lovely new prisons and they won't get filled up before they're built, and you can solve society's problems by sending people who have mental health problems or who are poor or who are actually just a ruddy nuisance into prison, and that will solve the problems, it's a mistake. Of course, you know that targets were also a mistake, and the targets given to police resulted in, again, in an explosion of easy arrests. Giving the police a target to arrest people meant that they arrested the easy people. They arrested a million child arrests in a couple of years, because they're easy. Much easier to arrest a naughty child than a serial burglar. So that's the mistakes. Don't build on those. Do something different in the future. Now, the success was probation, which was actually working incredibly well until Grayling destroyed it. In order to get out of that mess that Grayling created with the privatisation of community sentences, what you have to do in justice, as in other areas, is manage the contracts really carefully. Commissioning and contracting out is inherently bureaucratic. It requires a very competent bureaucracy to oversee the contracts so you can take them back when they fail. Not if they fail, but when they fail. Implement Causton, close women's prisons, have local and support the local women's centres, which were a great success. And Maria Eagle, as a prison minister, was fantastic. Sort out the magistrates. They are sending far too many people to prison, for example, on remand, 70% of whom won't get a custodial sentence. And deal with rhetoric. Be careful with the rhetoric you use, because actually, rather than legislation, it's the way you say things. It's the political temper of the nation which affects behaviour, particularly of the courts. So use evidence for the future, and be very, very careful with the rhetoric. And that means that in the future, a Labour government could have fewer people in prison, have less crime, and could have safer communities. Thank you.
One of the best four-minute time speeches I think I've heard. So we're having a very disciplined panel. I'm hoping you're all thinking of some very pert questions to ask, but if I could turn over now to Lucy.
Thanks. I'm afraid I've doubled Francis's points. I've got six, Francis and three. I'll try to do it within 4 minutes. So how then can Labour save fundamental rights? The first thing I think is very, very important, we've got to see, might sound like an odd point or an obvious one, we've got to see complete unity on this. There are, you may have spotted, some areas of disunity in Labour at the moment, but thankfully the shadow justice team, we've got Andy here, are, I, as far as I know, entirely united. And frankly, it would... Andy's raging. Frankly, I think, you know, it would be impossible, wouldn't it, to disagree with the fact that what the Tories have done to the justice system is, you know, has been utterly deplorable and totally nonsensical. So the second point, because this is justice is this area of kind of incontrovertible agreement, and because it deserves it, of course, I would like to see justice bumped up the political agenda. Most members of this party that I know are deeply, deeply attached to the 45 government's wins, I suppose, to put it like that, what Attlee did. Well, Attlee's 1949 Act, which established a system of legal aid, we hardly ever hear about that, do we? Now, and I know that, you know, the NHS, deservedly, we talk about it an awful lot, but, you know, and obviously health is a much more immediate need, but I would argue that legal aid is absolutely vital, and it is one of the areas, one of Attlee's great creations that we need to protect. Now, Jeremy Corbyn said recently that justice, access to justice, is a human right, and that's absolutely right. It's a basic in any civilised society. I think the way Labour needs to bring that home to people is by talking about it in terms of, you know, this is the stuff that lets you exercise the rights that let you live your life. It's about how you maintain a roof over your head, your right not to face discrimination at work, your ability to challenge a wrongful decision against you. We've got to talk about the Tory slashing of legal aid, and we've got to get the facts out there. You know, we literally have a scenario at the moment where our legal system is venerated around the world. You know, every decent-sized contract that I've ever looked at, every Russian billionaire that I've ever heard of, they all want their arguments heard in British courts, and they all want their contracts subject to English law. Yet at the same time, our justice system is purposefully, by design, out of reach for a great majority of those who are subject to it. That's extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary. So the importance of legal aid, I think, goes up the agenda. So do tribunal fees, which I could go on and on about. I won't. Ridiculous. Don't know, I won't. And, of course, the Human Rights Act, and I'll come back to that. The third point, very, very specifically, I think when we're pushing the case for legal aid, we need to talk about it in economic terms. I really do. Because, you know, I think if you make legal aid unavailable to the great majority of people who may need it, that's an entirely false economy. It just costs more down the track, be that money coming from the prisons budget, the health service budget. Fourthly, and I'm speeding up, when we're making these arguments, let's talk as much about liberties as we do about rights. And I don't mean, evidently, that I think there's any material difference between liberties and rights. I think most of us in this room would kind of use the terms almost interchangeably. But I think we'd all acknowledge also that there has been this, you know, this growing sense, particularly, oh, it's on the right, and it's particularly amongst the press, that section, they seem to have a fundamental problem with the fact that some of us have rights, and in particular they have a problem with the Human Rights Act. So let's talk about liberties just as much as we talk about rights. And, you know, Osborne called his daughter Liberty, for heaven's sake. So, you know, he's not going to... I think it's more difficult to disagree with people having liberties and to pick them as somehow kind of undesirable and un-British. Fifthly, we know the Tories want to scrap the Human Rights Act. We've got to be utterly vigilant about that. We need a cross-party inclusive campaign on that. And sixthly, I know maybe my time, so I will say we've got to be in the business not just of opposing but proposing. I think what we propose, we've got to see tribunal fees scrapped, obviously, and I'm on board with what Francis says about what previous Labour governments unfortunately have done to legal aid. It's been a bit of salami slicing. I think we need a commitment from Jeremy to a comprehensive and fair system of legal aid.
I'm just going to hand over to our fourth speaker, and then to remind you all, it will be open to questions. So please do be thinking about some difficult questions for our panellists. They are looking forward to them, I'm sure. Gordon.
Great. Well many, many thanks. As has been said, I was closely involved in the creation of the Human Rights Act. It was an enormous privilege to be able to work on such an important piece of legislation. But it does mean for me, having been present at the birth, as it were, that I find the current monstering of the Human Rights Act and its contents particularly painful and galling. And needless to say, I want to do my bit alongside Andy and the Labour front bench team to ensure that the Tories don't get their way and make it as difficult as possible. I subscribe to the Professor Herbert Hart idea that human rights are far too important to be left to lawyers. So despite the fact that I'm a lawyer, what I'd rather do, I think, in a short time, is say a little bit about the way that the human rights debate, this discussion we're having at the moment about the place of human rights, links to wider ideas that are discussed in society, and perhaps specifically how what politicians do and say itself influences the public mood within which that debate is received. And I think it's useful, those of you, it's great that many of you won't be able to cast your mind back to 1997 and the birth of the Human Rights Act, because fantastically, given the growth of membership of the Labour Party, many of you are too young. Of course, as ex-parliamentary council, I'm a bit of a legislative anorak and possibly followed that period more closely than others. But if you cast your mind back to what happened, the Human Rights Act 1998 followed a period of debate which Labour initiated while in opposition. There was an excellent paper published by the Labour Home Office team in opposition called Bringing Rights Home, which made an unambiguous case in support of ending this absurdity where people had to go to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg to vindicate rights, which they ought to be able to vindicate here in the Strand or in local courts. It was just absurd that we had to air our dirty linen in an international court simply so people could obtain redress, and Labour committed itself to bringing that absurd situation to an end and ensure that people could have remedies through the domestic legal system where their fundamental rights were infringed. And what Labour did through the Bringing Rights Home paper, through its promotion of the Human Rights Bill, through the Home Office as it became white paper under Jack Straw, Rights Brought Home, is that it created a hegemony of ideas in favour of civil liberties. It was extremely difficult at the time to be opposed to this agenda. Even the Tories, despite being egged on by Murdoch and other sections of the press who feared the creation of privacy rights and so on, and there were some other very, very odd sources of opposition to the Human Rights Bill. Bishops in the Church of England and the House of Lords, for example, were very concerned about the effect it might have on religious organisations. But despite that, the Tories were unable politically to oppose it. The best they could do was abstain in a rather curmudgeonly and parsimonious manner at second reading in the Commons. So that creation of a hegemony of ideas in favour of civil liberties, unambiguous support for a human rights agenda, was extremely important in isolating the Tories. We've now come full circle. The Tories feel the debate is shifting in their direction. They're emboldened to launch this frontal assault now on the Human Rights Act. And I think it's important to understand why. There are a number of reasons, but instrumental in that process, I think, has been that cooling of attitude towards the end of the Labour administration, pre-2010, towards human rights. You know, we had ID cards, we had the 90-day detention proposal. David Blunkett, this extraordinary outburst describing Liberty and other groups as bleeding heart liberals. Absolutely extraordinary. And that helped
create or destroyed a consensus in favour of human rights and created a situation in which, incredibly as it now may seem, back in 2010, the Tories went into that election attacking Labour from the left on civil liberties issues. And of course, that gave them the space, once they came to power, to revert to type. And the Lib Dems may say they contained the Tories. The Lib Dems did nothing to prevent attacks on legal aid, nothing to prevent attacks on judicial review. It was Labour who, quite rightly, led the opposition. And I think Labour's position now, the lesson of that period, is that Labour can't afford, in any sense, to be half-hearted about civil liberties. Only a completely unambiguous support for the civil liberties agenda, as we managed in 1997-98, is going to help bring the public debate around and isolate the Tories, as you managed to in 97. Is that the 4 minutes? That's great. I'll leave it on that note. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, everybody. Because the panellists have been so disciplined, we have plenty of time for questions. So if those of you who want to ask can put your hands up, say what your name is when you're called, and then give your question. Yes, madam.
Beth Lacani, I wanted to ask about access to justice. Really, it's the bottom end of the legal aid provision, which I wonder whether Labour could input into a new Human Rights Act, even if it's not then reflected, obviously, in the European based one, which would give people a right access to advice and representation in relation to social rights, as well as rights that may lead to their being in prison. But it would then extend to give people rights to advice and representation in relation to housing loss, tenancy loss, benefits loss, or a wrong decision. It also has an effect on the potential quality of the bureaucracy, because no challenges mean they can get away with murder.
Thank you. Anyone else? There's a gentleman right at the back there.
Hi, my name's Brian Austin. Up until very recently, I was a civil servant in the Ministry of Justice, and plenty of things happened whilst I was there which would make everybody in this room completely insane with anger. But one thing that I was party to when I was there was talking about the Human Rights Act, and quite serious conversations amongst senior civil servants about getting rid of or trying to find a way to justify things like the right to a fair trial. And one of the arguments they put forward was English law, or British law, doesn't need those rights to be entrenched. And I would say, and I said to them, that would you rather have a right all the time, except in very specific circumstances, or a right at only very specific circumstances, or all the time? And of course they would say all the time. I said, well, what's your problem with the Human Rights Act, or what's your problem with the right to a fair trial? But it always came down to, well, English law has plenty of provision for it. So my question would be, how would you take that narrative on and say, because they're not arguing that it's un-British to have that right, they're arguing that the British don't need it to be told to them by a court far away or even in their own law.
Okay, thank you. And if someone over here, you sir.
Yeah, Robert Allen, my question to the panel is about legal aid, criminal legal aid. If I can go back in time, I can remember a time when Labour was in opposition, and I used to attend SLL meetings, Society of Labour Lawyer meetings, and the party at that time was fully committed to funding legal aid. We got into government, we cut the budget. I remember being at one of these conferences and challenging the minister to cut the legal aid budget. If we come full forward to today, we have cuts to legal aid, we have firms of solicitors who are going. We're going to the situation where we're going to have massive firms. Those practitioners who, in all of the miscarriage of justice cases, there were four or five solicitors firms, those are going. You ask young people now, I talk to young lawyers, what it is they want to do. Crime doesn't pay, they say. Mm. All they want is to make a living. They're not going into crime. You're seeing it in the magistrates' courts in particular, the standard of advocacy is going down. People are not being represented. I think it's an absolute scandal. As you say, this government has done, but we, in the past in government, have turned the opposite way, have continuously cut the legal aid budget. What's the guarantee that we're going to put forward proposals that will do it? And if we reach government, are we going to do the same as we did before? The judges, too, are concerned. who are the future judges? They come from the bar, they come from solicitors, they too, although private, then say they are concerned.
Okay.
So that's the question.
Thank you very much. Well, Francis, as you were dead on 4 minutes, I think you should start us off.
There are a lot of questions which are well outside my remit. I just want to say that the justice system and the way that we make our justice is the most important, I think, thing in the country. The way that you deal with conflict between citizens is a fundamental part of a democracy. And that legal aid and the right to justice, the way into justice, being able to access justice, is absolutely essential. And if you get that wrong, you end up with a right old muddle. And I'll give you an example. The Howard League is actually challenging, and we're involved in something called Jarndyce and Jarndyce, I think. We've got a judicial review challenging the government's cuts to legal aid for prisoners. And we've been doing it for a year, and we've been given a listing for 2017. However, we're still fighting it as a charity with no funding. Just putting that out there. If you don't give prisoners legal representation when they're coming up in certain parole cases, what you do is they stay in prison for longer. And it costs more. Not only is it incredibly unfair, but it clogs up the prisons and it costs more, and it's a muddle. So legal aid is absolutely essential to fight for, because it's part of our democracy, because it's part of our citizenship, and because if we don't get it wrong, it just costs more in the long run. So for principle and practice reasons, it's got to be a fundamental part of what Labour has to do next time.
Okay, if I can ask Lucy to reply and then Andy.
Sure, I think, Robert, I'm with you in terms of what the previous Labour governments have done. And I think there are 11 law centres that closed around the country in the last 2 years. So we are seeing kind of effectively advice deserts. Fewer and fewer solicitors and barristers are doing legal aid work. And I think overall we're moving to what looks a lot more like the US system, where I think there's either, is it no legal aid or very, very scant legal aid, but people are entirely reliant on lawyers acting pro bono, which is this kind of, well, I think this hideous kind of Victorian philanthropy type, you know, dependent on other people's charity. It's absolutely grim. Just to address the Human Rights Act point, I think the Tories, I mean, Andy will be able to speak to this far better than I will, but they seem to be tying themselves up in knots, actually, on this Human Rights Act stuff, with the British Bill of Rights as well. I mean, it was in their 2010 manifesto, I think. And then, you know, it's in their manifesto again to scrap the HRA and have a British Bill of Rights. They convened a committee to decide what should be in the British Bill of Rights, and they had to disband it, I think, because no one could decide what British rights were. You know, so, and presumably, someone, you know, also said, well, actually, what British rights are is, you know, contained in the Human Rights Act already. I mean, I'm confident that Gove will try his kind of evil worst with it, and I say, you know, be vigilant. But, you know, I think it's a mess. It's a total mess.
Well, Andy, I think some points got kicked over to you to handle there. So what do you make?
Yeah, well, first of all, on the Human Rights Act, to disappoint the first questioner, we have talked about this at length, and we're not going to look to extend the ambit of the Act. We're looking specifically to defend it as it is, and there's two main reasons for that. One is there's a certain simplicity about having incorporated the European Convention into domestic law, which is effectively what the Act does. It's quite a short and I think easily comprehensible piece of legislation, although the Tories and others willfully misinterpret it. I mean, for example, the fact that there is no requirement, it does not bind the UK courts. It's something which they have to take into consideration. But the second reason, I think that's the way to build the biggest consensus. Of course, we could have a long discussion about how we could expand, what additional rights should be put in. But part of our defence, and this sort of comes on to the second question, is that relationship between domestic and international law, which has come about through the incorporation of the Convention, which of course itself, as often said, and bears repeating, was drafted primarily by British lawyers. It's just that there was that short hiatus between the 1940s and the 1990s when it was actually being incorporated. So, I mean, that's where we will come from. But although I say that we're not looking to expand the ambit of it, of course, human rights is a lot broader than the Act as well. We and our international obligations, which is essentially what this is a battle about this ludicrous idea that you can have British rights which are somehow different from other rights, is clearly important. And so when you're looking, there are many, many other treaty obligations on the rights of the child, other conventions against tortures, on the rights of women and disabled people, through the UN as well as through the EU and through the Council of Europe, that we are signed up to. And it seems to us to be just an impossibility that they are going to somehow detach us from all of that intricate network brought up over time, and just in a very crude way say, well, this is what British rights are and this is what British rights are not. I think it's going to be quite a battle, but I suspect it is a battle that we can win. It won't be easy, because there will be all this misinformation in the media, and the Sun and the Mail are just waiting to ramp that up. But there is broad support amongst all the opposition parties, and significant, small but significant, given the small size of the Tory majority, and the quality of the people, the Dominic Greaves and the David Davises, who do oppose it, which makes me think that we can push it through. And I'm just slightly worried by what I said at the beginning, this latest tendency to try and wrap it up with EU bashing as well. Briefly on the criminal legal aid front, for those who don't know what's happening on that, the Tories proposed two things. They proposed a cut of 17.5% in fees for criminal solicitors, which had already not gone up for a very long period of time, which, you know, a very substantial cut. Half of it came in, half of it was due to come in this year and has been postponed, but they're still intending to do that. But the other thing, which in some ways the professional bodies objected to, well, as much if not more, was a change to the way that contracts worked, which effectively was going to lead to advice and representation deserts across the country. A system which, on the government's own methodology, just simply will not work. And that is now subject to litigation and therefore is also delayed. And that's why not very much is happening at the moment. But if it does go through, then it will mean, it was bad enough looking at the cuts in civil legal aid, which Ken Clark introduced, because that affected not just private family law, but social welfare law as well. But when you're talking about effectively restricting people's ability to get advice at the police station, on arrest, or representation in serious criminal trial, that really gives you an indication of how low the government has sunk in those respects. And this issue about litigants in person, again, I'll refer to the Lord Chief Justice report, 25% increase in the last year. Well, he's worried about it primarily because it's clogging up the courts. Litigants in person will take many, many more times than those who are represented. It's a really weird thing, isn't it, litigants in person? You wouldn't say, well, we can do without surgeons and we can do our own operations, or we can do without surveyors. But somehow lawyers as professionals, oh, anybody can do that. I mean, it's so ludicrous in those terms. But it's an increasing trend. And the latest development, so I'll finish with by raising the small claims threshold to £5,000, as they're going to do without consultation now, from £1,000 for personal injury cases, will take 90 to 95% of all personal injury cases out of the cost regime, and therefore they will be unrepresented. Mm-hmm. So quite serious, and you have to be quite seriously injured to get £5,000 in general damages in this country. It could be an old lady who's fallen down a pothole. It could be somebody who's had their finger cut off at work, as well as road traffic. We don't quite know how far the ambit's going to go. That was announced in the comprehensive spending review by George Osborne, with whom he has nothing to do with public finances or indeed the Treasury, because he said it would bring car insurance premiums down by £40. I mean, what a world to be living in, the idea that you're no longer going to be able to recover for certain heads of damages, for whiplash and other injuries. And if you are able to, you will have to do all the litigation yourself, even at a time that you may be unfit for work because of the nature of your injury. It's extraordinary.
Gordon, before we go to the next round of questions, I think it would be interesting to have your observations on that second question about how we take on the narrative, which seems to be evolving, about the Human Rights Act and the English law without the intervention of European law, as it's talked about, would be able to cover not having a Human Rights Act at all.
This is interesting because one of the reasons why Parliament, in a sense, took over the initiative of implementing the conventions, because there were signs that the judges were going to do it themselves. People tend to forget just how unpopular the Tory government, when Michael Howard was Home Secretary, made itself, not just with Labour voters, but with almost every echelon of society, where they gradually managed to alienate themselves from section after section of society, including the judiciary. And what was starting to happen in the 3 or 4 years before 1997 was that the judges were gradually informally incorporating elements of the European Convention of Human Rights into English law. It's very hard to know where that was going to go. And during the debates on the Human Rights Bill, the then Labour Lord Chancellor, Derry Irving, made the point that what had taken place in New Zealand, the enactment of the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act, repaid careful study. And it does repay careful study because the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act was actually the New Zealand Parliament's reaction to a number of increasingly shrill pronouncements from the New Zealand judiciary, led by the New Zealand Chief Justice, entirely coincidentally named Robin Cook, who started hinting that if Parliament continued in ordinary legislation to infringe rights, then he and his colleagues would introduce a doctrine of soft entrenchment of rights, looking a little bit like a dilute version of the US Supreme Court, which has a very hard-edged power to strike down legislation as unconstitutional. And the New Zealand Parliament decided it didn't want to go there. And I think there's a serious question of if Labour hadn't incorporated the Human Rights Act in the very carefully balanced way it did, preserving parliamentary sovereignty and striking creating a very careful architecture to ensure sovereignty was preserved while the judges were enabled to declare if they found a piece of legislation problematic in rights terms. There was a real possibility that the judges would have taken the Constitution in a direction that many Democrats would have found very uncomfortable. And I think that danger, if the Tories were successful in simply eliminating any domestic incorporation of the ECHR, would pose itself. So in fact, and I think this is an important part of the narrative, a Human Rights Act incorporating the Convention is actually an exercise by Parliament of its sovereign power to ensure we have a Constitution that's made by people electing representatives, not by an unelected judiciary. That's an important part of the narrative that I think has been ignored in all this.
Yeah. I think that's a very important contribution. If we could have three more questions, if there's anyone who's standing, because I think you're being particularly troopers, that lady over there.
Thank you. My name's Rebecca. Firstly, impute anybody who's going to do law by themselves in fact, to take my service provider to court for breaking their tenancy agreement. Good luck to me. Fortunately, my mum is a barrister, so she's helping me a bit. Not her area of law, but she has been practising at the bar for over 40 years, and she's been particularly practising in family law, defending parents who are losing their children to adoption. And she's just seen things get worse and worse and worse. It's disheartening, the sort of stories you hear. And it's got particularly bad where adoption cases are now being rushed through the family courts before criminal cases have finished. So parents are unfairly losing their children, and once their children are adopted, they can't get them back. What do we do about this? I mean, would David Cameron like to lose his children unfairly? It's just heartbreaking. But he seems to think, oh, it's just a casualty of changes.
Yeah. And there's a lady over here who's been standing as well.
The Tories have been able to use the Human Rights Act, the abolition of the Human Rights Act, in conjunction with lots of other things, terrorism, the immigration, and also cost savings. Is there a place for efficiency in the justice system? Is there a place for specialist courts, fast-tracking of asylum seekers? Or is this just something that should be an absolute Human Rights Act, an absolute system whereby we just fund everything and everybody because that's what's good for our justice system? Or is there actually room for being imaginative and reclaiming that cost-saving analysis from the Tories and saying, yeah, okay, we understand what you're saying, and here are some ways of entrenching our human rights, also addressing a cost-savings perspective.
Great. And do I have one more question? lady over there. Yes, yes, you.
It's a question for Gordon, really. This morning about the changes to legal aid, this morning, just talking generally, one of the speakers was talking about the fact that we should address things that have happened, if you like, since 1945, changes to public services and legal aid, we can think of in those terms, but we don't necessarily bring it back as it was. And I'm thinking in those terms, it's a question for everyone, but I'm thinking particularly of Gordon. And I know it's a different legal system across the whole of Europe, but how do we compare the terms of funding of rights to justice with Europe? And are there different ways in which we could bring back legal aid from how it was before? Because it was seen as expensive. Whether it was expensive in comparison, I don't know.
Before I hand over to Gordon to start the responses, I just wanted to pick up on something that Andy said, where he was comparing the popularity of surgeons and, may I say, junior doctors versus lawyers. I'm sure the lawyers of us looking out onto this very full room may start to think we're popular, but the reality is, when there have been strikes, for example, by barristers and various other things to highlight these issues, they haven't been very popular at all. So maybe if the panel could also comment on how we get those issues out into the wider populace and make them feel that they're also invested in them. Gordon.
Yes, can I deal with this question of legal aid? The Tories are very fond of defending their cuts in legal aid by saying, well, we've been spending more on legal aid than anyone else, say, within the EU. And what they're not doing is comparing like with like, because you're quite right to say that legal systems differ, and particularly they differ in relation to the point of the process at which money has to be spent. Now, most civil law jurisdictions, or non-common law jurisdictions, where you have a codified criminal and civil law, and court procedures in criminal cases that are still adversarial to some extent, give the judge a much more prominent role in researching the law and so on, and running the file. Inevitably, in systems of that sort, to achieve justice, you have to spend more on the judges and the infrastructure of the courts, and because advocates have a lesser role, then you spend less on legal aid. So you have to compare like with like, and I thought this might come up. And so I brought the statistics with me. As well as a member of as being a member, by the way, of the SLL, Society of Labour Lawyers, which has been mentioned, I'm also a member of the Hawling Society of Socialist Lawyers, many of whose members are members of the Labour Party, some aren't, but it's excellent at disseminating information. And it very recently circulated this fact sheet from young legal aid lawyers, and I'd recommend anyone who's interested is to go and look at it. They have a website, www.younglegalaidlawyers.org. And the figures are very telling. Figures compiled, they say, by the National Audit Office on spending within the EU on criminal courts, prosecution and legal aid cumulatively as a percentage of GDP. We found expenditure in England and Wales to be bang in the middle, in the average. So you've got to accumulate legal aid with expenditure on the prosecution service in courts because of different roles. And when the European Commission, this is quite recently, studied the efficiency of justice comparing the European legal systems, it ranked England and Wales 9th out of 46 for value for money based on legal spend per inhabitant. So our legal spend per inhabitant was €96.50, a lower figure than Germany, Norway, Netherlands and Sweden, and much lower than Switzerland, which of course isn't in the EU, at €197.70. And lower than Luxembourg, which is very often hailed as a paragon of parsimony. Their spend was €147.10. So once you compare like with like, you see that actually legal aid isn't the whole picture, and you need to examine spend as a whole. So there's no reason for us to be squeamish about what we spend on legal aid in our system. I don't think we should be defensive about it. On the contrary, by spending money on legal aid, what you do, and Lucy made this point in relation to the last round of questions, you save money elsewhere in the system.
Gordon, what an excellent Fabian answer, very evidence-based, we like that. Andy, if I can hand over to you.
Yeah, well, I think Gordon's dealt with that point. And the only thing I would add to that is that I can't prejudge what's going to be a very comprehensive view that is just starting on for legal aid by Shadow Justice team, not the Shadow Justice, but by an expert panel appointed by my colleagues. But I would be surprised if we look to simply go back to where we were 5-6 years ago A, because it wasn't perfect, and B, because I suspect that there will still be pressures on the public finances. And ironically, we may be looking towards slightly more European models, which are more investigative than adversarial justice, more ADIs, alternative dispute resolution, which brings me back to the first point on family law. The reason that family law has been such a car crash over the past few years is that we were told, and to some extent we believed, and therefore I don't think we opposed the cuts so much in family law as we did in, say, social welfare law, that mediation would step in to a large extent and replace it. Well, mediation has bombed just as much as adversarial hearings. I think we would all like to see better use of mediation in family disputes, but A, it isn't happening at the moment, and B, where contested issues are still going to trial, people are often unrepresented, which often means, and it's usually, I'm afraid, the woman, because the woman is usually the, where it's a husband-wife or partner's dispute, is usually the one who is less able to afford representation privately. And that is a real problem in the family courts, with everything from injustices through to delay in that process, and it's something which they've singly failed at, even within their own terms. On the other point, which was, which I think is a very good point. You know, we can't just criticise; we have to also say what our solutions will be. And yes, there are inefficiencies in all parts of the system, and that includes in human rights law and in European law. But it's not my words; it's Ken Clark who said, "And we sorted them out." There were issues like the quality of judges in the European Court, massive backlog of cases, the fact that they were clearly considering far too many cases, the fact that they weren't using things like the margin of appreciation, which allows for a greater independence of individual jurisdictions in the way. Most of those issues have been or are being sorted out. This is not, so don't be fooled into thinking that this is about that. This is about something which is a system which isn't working. It's about a system that has problems, which is being reformed. This is about taking away people's fundamental human rights. There is no cost aspect to that at all, really. And very finally, on the lawyer strike, when I did PR for the Bar Council in the mid 1980s, not many people know that, and I helped organise the first ever barrister's strike, I think, then in the time. So it's not a new thing. I don't know if you were striking at the time. You were a young
I'm not
lawyer
a
at the time.
But I went along and showed
indeed.
Solidarity.
So there we are. But it is a problem. It's a problem not just for lawyers, but it's a problem for the law generally, that the NHS is always going to get the headlines and the public sympathy more so. And part of that is for obvious reasons. But the main reason is that everybody uses the NHS all the time. People only go to lawyers when they're in trouble. Then they do sing their praises. But somehow we have to make that connection.
Great. Lucy?
Just a follow on, actually, from that point about, I suppose, public opinion. Actually, there was a study by Hodge, Jones and Allen relatively recently, and they found that only one in four of the UK population think that the current legal system is fair in terms of access to justice, which is quite interesting. And three in four people said that money is the largest factor in determining access to justice. So, you know, I take your point about barristers perhaps not being the most popular, not necessarily most easily demonstrating solidarity with them. But I think, you know, there is certainly a making the argument on legal aid, on the Human Rights Act, on tribunal fees. There is, you know, it could be a fruitful campaign for Labour as well, obviously, as being right. Good luck with your case, of course. A terrible example. A terrible insight into what's happening in the family courts, but also an excellent example. So it'd be wonderful if Labour could use that and get that out there more. On innovation, no objection at all to, you know, innovation, I think, fantastic. Obviously, we should be doing more of it, but let's not pretend that what's happening at the moment is saving us money, because, as we've all said, it's an entirely false economy.
Francis.
Goodness, quite a lot there. access to justice is different, or particularly the criminal justice system is completely different to the NHS. As Andy said, the NHS is universal. We'll all use it at some point, and we all want it to be there for A&E and for all those things. So it's universal, no matter how rich, no matter how poor. But the criminal law is quite different, because the criminal law actually punishes poor people. And that's why the Tories don't care. And actually, I've just stepped out of my charity, so don't quote me on this. I mean, the cuts to, if you go and sit in a magistrate's court, the flow of people coming through, are they're all poor people. Mm. And the magistrates aren't, I have to say. And the magistrates are 95%, or more than that, 95% white as well. And the people who are using it, and the system aren't. So there's a real class issue here, which we have to face up to. And that's why cutting legal aid, particularly in criminal cases, actually is not a big issue for this government. It's a big issue because they're doing it very deliberately. Innovation, I think, is really important. And I would like to see more innovation, perhaps from this government, talking perhaps about the big issues that are failing in the criminal justice system, how it is all about punishment. And I don't like the rhetoric about punishment. I want a criminal justice system that makes things better, not worse. I want a criminal justice system that tries to heal the damage that's done by crime. Crime is very corrosive. It is very damaging. I've just read on the BBC website that somebody who was stabbed in the street just next to where I live has died. And the whole of my community is talking about that. It's very, very corrosive and very damaging. We somehow need a system which makes things better. Now, I don't think you can do that just by tinkering around by having specialist court systems for domestic violence or for domestic abuse or for veterans or whatever. I think we need to talk about what is the system for and somehow put victims more at the centre, not by exploiting them and by upping the punishment, which is what happens too often from both sides of the political spectrum, but by looking at trying to make healing it. And within that, it's restorative justice. It's changing the system from a system we've had for 2,000 years, which is about you've hurt someone, so we're going to hurt you. I want to change the system, you've hurt someone, this is wrong, let's try and make things better. And that means about restoring, about healing, and about a system which is a fundamental principle is completely different. And that could also be more equal. So it's a much more fundamental change, and I think will take a lot of time.
So could I jump in with a very short point about mediation, if I may, just to reinforce something Andy said. And it makes a very good point about mediation, but the point about mediation is that it's highly dependent for its success on there being readily available, reliable advice. Because mediation is a consensual process. It only works if the parties agree. And that means someone has to be advising one of the parties along the lines of, look, this offer that's on the table now, you do realise that if you go to court and reject that offer, you're not going to do any better. The chances are you may do a lot worse. If the parties aren't advised, mediation is completely pointless. So if you use mediation simply as an excuse for or part of a cost-cutting exercise, it doesn't work. If you use it as a component of a properly funded justice system, then it can work very effectively.
Okay. Well, I think if I can get three very short questions, then we can just have another round. So you had your hand up, I remember, earlier as well. Okay, if you start.
Thank you, Sarah. My name is Richard Dunstan. I'm a policy wonk with an interest in employment rights. So like Lucy, I could and indeed do go on and on about employment tribunal fees.
With great charts.
Destroyed access to justice in the workplace. Lucy said that the fee should be scrapped, but as Andy knows very well, because he and I just discussed this as well, that comes with a cost of £20 million a year to the Ministry of Justice, and before the general election, the two Eds refused to fund that in the manifesto. And that takes you back, it's not really so much a question as a point, your point, Lucy, about we can't just oppose, we have to propose. And there are alternatives, in fact, to scrapping fees that would retain access or restore access to justice and yet somehow fill that £20 million hole. And I think we do have to give careful consideration to those alternatives.
Okay. Any other questions?
madam, you there?
Hi, I'm Claire. I'm a law student and I ran a politics blog during the general election. I'm personally, as I'm sure everyone in this room is, very sympathetic to Francis's stance on rehabilitative and restorative justice, but the electorate notoriously aren't. One of the reasons that New Labour was instrumental in driving this narrative of punitive justice is because it's a vote winner. Mm-hmm. How does the Labour, in order to save fundamental rights, you need to persuade people that on the criminal justice front that they're worth saving. How does Labour go about constructing that narrative with 5 years to the next general election?
Okay, and there's a lady at the back who's standing. Yes?
Hi, I was wondering if Professor Francis Crick, if you had a response to one of my perceptions and experiences. My name is Shahanara Islam. I grew up in Tower Hamlets. Around the 1990s, I come from a very strong Bangladeshi community where I saw a lot of Bengali men, especially growing up, being addicted to heroin, including my own brother. And what I've seen is that a lot of families who grew up impoverished didn't really have access to the sort of, you know, middle class education, that sort of support network, becoming even more impoverished by the laws around heroin, for example, my family including, being further impoverished because of the penalties we faced as a result of my brother going to prison again and again without any proper medical support, any proper legal support. He's just come out of prison last year. The prison didn't find him any accommodation. They just left him. He had to go back to my family home. We've all had to escape because there's someone dealing and taking part in drugs in the house. We're no longer safe physically or mentally. What I really want to ask is, if we're going to say fundamental rights, am I yourself included in that, and also my brother? I feel like we have to also look at the rights, you know, the rights to education, the rights to empower people to have the capacity to access the legal aid. It's not enough just to give money and make sure there's a pot of money, but how do we empower people to actually, you know, get legal aid in the first place and educate them? And how do we provide that particular, you know, social network and the support network there to give them the access to justice? And yeah, I suppose as far understanding, how do we link up society in general and link up all these different rights, such as, you know, the right to have a safe home, the right to have access to education, the right to have access to the legal courts? I just feel like we're looking at things in quite an isolated manner, in a sense, just concentrating on the lack of legal aid, when actually we have to look at things in a much more holistic way.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think those are an excellent three questions to end on. And given that last question is about how we put everything into the round, I'm going to ask all the speakers to talk about their summing up comments that they may have at the same time as well. Frances, I think that last question was very much addressed at you. So if you could start.
The idea of restorative justice, or a different narrative, I don't think the general British public actually is as punitive as Labour thought they were. The last Labour government was enthralled to the Daily Mail, and you have to move away from that. I think, actually, if you talk about justice in a different way, most people want something done, but they don't necessarily want to inflict lots of pain on people. They feel frustrated because they don't really understand the system, and and it takes too long, and it's not explained well. But actually, what they want is someone to make amends for the wrong they've done in a constructive way. I do a lot of local radio phone-ins, and wearing a completely different hat from my Howard League hat, I was actually an elected councillor for 8 years, so I do a lot of doorstep work as well. You know, I actually think you can create a narrative about justice which is not as punitive, as long as it looks as though something is being done and people are being asked to change their lives. And if you involve victims in saying that, you get a very good, very positive narrative. Victims of crime want to feel safe. They want something done, but they don't necessarily want to inflict more pain. So I think that's very positive. And what you're saying about drugs laws in particular, our view is very much that you should decriminalise. I'm not I'm still not convinced that legalising drugs, so you get lots of adverts for my heroin's better than your heroin, take Rothman's heroin as opposed to Marlborough heroin. You know, I think I'd be a bit careful about that. But decriminalisation, so that drugs are treated as a health issue, not a justice issue. You can't punish a heroin addict out of their addiction. And of course, as we know, prisons are awash with drugs. They're awash with legal drugs, they're awash with illegal drugs, and they're awash with prescription drugs, which is why so many people are dying in prisons. And so many people die when they come out of prison, because, of course, who's waiting for them outside in the car when the people come out of prison? The dealer. And if you really want to make a lot of money out of drug dealing, you do it in prisons, because there's a very inflated market, because the more security you put in, the more it inflates the market. So that is not the way to go. So actually, I think it would be very brave of Labour to say they will decriminalise drugs, but they'll put in a lot of support services so that it's a health issue. I don't think people should take drugs. I don't think people should get drunk. But generally, we should all lead a healthy life, and we should all run marathons, and we should never drink anything or take drugs or smoke or anything. Life is not like that. So what we have to do is to put a network and a framework around, which is about being as healthy as possible and being as healthy as possible towards each other as well.
Lucy, you said you wanted to go on and on about ET fees, and I think that first question is your opportunity to do that if you've got any remarks on that topic.
Yeah, I think I'll spare you all me going on and on and on about employment tribunal fees, but I think, I mean, Richard, your 20 million, I take, it's a large figure, but, you know, this is about the importance of those, you know, justice in all of the other, you know, issues of the day. And 20 million in the context of something like, and I probably shouldn't say this because I'll elicit some kind of reaction, but Trident, you know, is actually not that much. And really, you think about the effect of the fee. I mean, we're creating a situation where employers know now that some employees will not be able to enforce their rights. So why abide by the law? I mean, that is the question, and that is a scenario that we just cannot have in a civilised country. It is that important for me, and I hope it is for everyone else as well.
Gordon, if I could have your comment.
But this question of public attitudes, I think, is a very important one, and I tried to develop that theme in my initial remarks. So let me come back, if I may, to that question. I think on all these issues, it depends how you pose it. If you ask people the question, do you think those who cause misery by committing crime against innocent victims should be dealt with perfunctorily and severely, you will get one answer. If you pose the question, how would you feel if you or a close member of your family were charged with a serious offence, what would your expectations be about the minimum standards the justice system ought to extend to you? You'll get a very different response. And in fact, the Bar Council, and we did some work in the early noughties, I think it was, when I name-checked David Blunkett once, I'll name-check him again, and I'm afraid in no less unfavourable light. When David Blunkett attempted to, one nice way of putting it would be to redistribute business between the magistrates' courts and the Crown Court, another way of putting it would be to attack the right to trial by jury. The Bar Council is very concerned about it, and we did some work with a couple of the pollsters, putting the question in different ways, and sure enough, if you put it, should we save money by ensuring that cases that are likely to end up in guilty pleas anyway are dealt with in the magistrates' court rather than the Crown Court, you get one answer. If you say to people, how would you feel if you were charged with a serious offence? Would you rather be tried by a jury of your peers, or we didn't put it quite like this, three suburban individuals sitting in the magistrates' court who are likely to be of a different colour and socioeconomic class to you, as has been said, and you get another answer. I think our skill between now and 2020 is going to be in the way we pose these issues. You know, we're on your side, and we want to ensure that if you found yourself, as is not impossible, charged with a serious offence, who knows, even a terrorist offence, that we want a system which would give you the minimum protections of justice that you'd expect. And just the final point is this, if I can, just this question of linking rights in, and the culture of rights, not just this rather narrow concept of civil liberties, but also other rights in society. I think it probably starts when we win in 2020, in the way in which the business of government is done. It's very interesting to hear from the person at the back who said he'd been a civil servant in Mulch. And having served in the government legal service, I can entirely relate to what was said. The culture among the civil servants, and I think ministers tend to get hijacked all too easily by this, is, well, here you've got a series of constraints on the government's freedom of action. You've got e-law, EU law, you've got human rights law, you've got judicial review. What do we think is the most we can get away with? I think that culture has to go. The real purpose of a piece of legislation like the Human Rights Act is not as a constraint on government, inviting the question, how far can we go before we challenge? It's rather, here is a statement of the fundamental values that society should further, that government is the custodian of. How can we best give effect to these rights and the expectation we create? And I hope that after 2020, starting with ministers and then infecting, I hope, the whole civil service culture, we can turn that round.
Andy, if I could ask you, in your concluding remarks, to deal with the question Claire raised, how are we going to turn all of these issues into vote winners in 2020?
If the guy from the MOJ is still here, I'd quite like a word as well. maybe some interesting. Can I just say something on unemployment tribunal fees? Because we perhaps weren't as clear as we could have been. Partly it straddles two departments. I think it was Jukka who actually made the announcement on that and did say that we would ensure that there would be access. Now, I think that effectively was saying that we would remove the fees, or at least remove them to a nominal level. That's certainly my interpretation of it. And although, yeah, you can't go just spending money that you don't have. I'm very aware of that, if you're going to be credible, and that was part of the issue of the last election. But actually, on that particular issue, the cost-benefit, numbers of cases falling by 80%, it's just so extreme. What is in budgetary terms, even MOJ terms, a relatively small amount of money. I would hope that when we address that and when we propose that, that's exactly what we will be doing. But to take those other two questions together, because I think there was some there's some continuity there, and it is around this issue about reform. Something went wrong I don't think it's all the previous Labour government's fault was wrong with the justice system, prior to that crisis. But things did start going wrong in the 90s, particularly when Michael Howard was Home Secretary. You can actually get away with a lot in justice. Some of the big, most important reforms happened under Thatcher. You look at how sentencing changed for the good in terms of intelligent non-custodial sentencing. All came in under Thatcher. It was only when in the latter years, in the major years, ironically, and then thereafter, that changed again. And we nearly doubled the prison population. That can't be right, can it? Just logic suggests that we're not twice as evil as a society as we were 20 years ago. I think we should take advantage of what Gove is saying, because I think if there can be some, we can depoliticise some of these messages, and that's better. Whatever his motives are, if he's prepared to stand up to the Tory right and the Daily Mail and say that we need prison reform and we need to look at why we send people to prison and for how long and issues like that, that's something, and Charlie Faulkner's already said that, on which we are happy to listen and, if he's got sensible proposals, to support. Because so much around what's happening in prisons now is to do with drugs and mental health and other things which are not classic custodial problems. But why is it getting worse? It's getting worse because most of the experienced staff have gone. Prisoners are being locked up for 23 hours a day. They're not getting association, they're not getting education, they're not getting work. The actual conditions in our prisons are worse than they've been for many, many years. So the rhetoric is all very well. What we have to do is actually tackle those problems, because that's part of the reoffending cycle. If people are coming out with worse addictions than they went into without having obtained skills, as well as not being given support when they come out, it's not rocket science, is it? I got an answer to a parliamentary question this week that said that nearly 10% of people are convicted of an offence that they commit within 18 days of coming out of prison. Now, we know that the overall reoffending rates are terrible. Two-thirds of people tend to go back within a year or so. But within 2 weeks, that's the ones who are convicted. That's the ones who are caught, tried, and resentenced. That is an appalling legacy. And yes, there is blame that needs to be shared across the board. But what we need these are early days, and we're not going to come up with a full set of policies overnight. But what I hope we are now doing under Charlie and under Jeremy is looking to be a genuine reforming government next time on justice issues. A, because I think we should, and B, because I think we will have to, because things will be in such a poor state that simply tinkering around the edges will not be possible. And I think with Jeremy Corbyn as leader, I think it's one of his huge strengths. This is something that he's believed in and campaigned on over the 30, 35 years that he's been active in politics in the House of Commons. He knows what he's talking about on legal aid. He knows what he's talking about on prisons. And I think that will add massively, if you like, to our clout, which is normally not very great with all the competing issues that are there. So that's about the best comfort I think I can give for today.
Fantastic. Thanks.
Right, well, in 5 minutes, the Fabian debate continues in the main hall. But thank you very much to the panel who are both engaged and engaging, and to the audience. Thank you.
That was very positive.
Yeah. Good. Things are hungover.
Outrageous.
I know.
Outrageous.
I'm Andy.
I'm
from the Trust to Ask. Yes. So I just wanted to make an observation.
Yes.
I work for LexisNexis, which you've probably heard.
I have indeed. Yes.
And, you know, as a company, we have a policy about supporting the rule of law. And so, you know, there's various initiatives we get involved with all over the world. You know, and it's things about human trafficking or whatever. But at our company meeting, the most recent one, we had all shown a little video about the rule of law, and it was actually focusing on the situation in this country and the appalling lack of access to justice. And, you know, that says it all, I think, really.
Well, it does. I think it's a final that they're going to have to win as the only able winner, because at the moment, yes, it seems to be a niche of lawyers who are hyper concerned about this and the wider population.
So you're just here as a speaker?
No.
I still have faith that it's going to get better.
Well,
maybe not immediately.
We could only hope.
Exactly.
It actually creates
in a way.
Exactly.